Hello, and welcome to Focus. I'm Paul Nelson. If a study of war teaches us one thing, it's that the ramifications continue long after the shooting stops. Today, we look at how the need to dominate has shaped American culture and the limitations of that shape. Dr. Rudy Reiser runs the Center for World Indigenous Studies, and he says the main threat to Americans is not terrorism, but forgetfulness.
Indigenous peoples know their culture, and non-Indigenous peoples have forgot. The consequence of having forgot one's culture is that it's easy to do violence on other things, thinking there are no consequences. When you recognize and comprehend your own culture, violence has consequences, and they are immediate and they're present.
The medicine that Indigenous peoples have for the world is evident in the wisdom shared by Dr. Rudy Reiser today, the chair of the Center for World Indigenous Studies. A fascinating program has just begun. Thanks for tuning in. Support for this program comes from KRCC, your local government information cable TV channel 24/7 in Pierce County, Washington. Channel 22 or 28 on Comcast Cable, 86 on the Click Network, and streaming online at rcc.pierce.wa.us. Local issues, local information, local governments, KRCC. And by Quanta Web Design, with affordable, personalized web design and web mastering for small business, nonprofits, individuals, and the arts. QuantaWebDesign.com or call Denise Enk, toll-free, 877-570-6448. For details on program guests, underwriters, or upcoming programs, or to find out other stations and airtimes for this show, check out the website for It Plays in Peoria Productions at inpeoria.org. That's inpeoria.org. You'll find show summaries, contact information, details on the organization, and links to our other projects, the Northwest Spoken Word Lab and auburncommunityradio.com. inpeoria.org, another village building project of the nonprofit organization known as It Plays in Peoria Productions. The debate over federal legislation to overhaul the Medicare program has largely been about the way to provide senior citizens with prescription drugs. To proponents of natural medicine, this must be a fascinating dialogue. As Albert Einstein once said, sometimes two sides disagree because they're both wrong. The people at the Center for Traditional Medicine point out that culture shapes illness as well as informs treatment, and they seek ways to deconstruct the dynamics of dominance as it affects relationships among humans, animals, and the natural world. The Center for Traditional Medicine is a project of the Center for World Indigenous Studies, based in Olympia, Washington. The center is dedicated to wider understanding and appreciation of the ideas and knowledge of indigenous peoples. Dr. Rudy Reiser is the co-founder and board chair for the center, a member of the Cowlitz Indian Tribe. For more than 30 years, Rudy has worked in the field of Indian affairs as a writer, researcher, and Indian rights advocate. Rudy, we appreciate you being on the program today.
It's good being here.
What a background you have. What important and very inspiring work. Now, I understand that the way indigenous people and the dominant culture deal with medicine is only one aspect of the center's work. So for those who've never heard about the Center for World Indigenous Studies, can you tell us more about how the center was founded and what its mission is?
The center, it was established, first of all, about 24 years ago, under authority of a resolution passed by tribes in the Pacific Northwest of the United States and a conference of tribal governments. And the resolution called for the establishment of a documentation and research center. And we were really set up to serve as a distribution and research entity that would help the tribes support their own information exchanges. But by 1983, we found ourselves being asked by the World Council of Indigenous Peoples to perform the same function for Indigenous peoples around the world. And so just as we found it fairly easy to say, sure, we'll do that with tribes here in the Northwest, the response was essentially the same in 1983. So we didn't really become formalized, at least in terms of U.S. organization, U.S. Incorporation, until 1984. But as far as tribal incorporation, it was 1979. And over the years, we've found ourselves responding more and more to research and educational interests of tribes, and so we've expanded to inquiries into not only political kinds of questions, as often was the case, and economic questions, but natural health and medicine questions, and cultural questions. Educational programs are simply a way of distributing a lot of the material that we then began developing. We have a kind of curious center in that we're not central to anything. We chose center simply because people in the United States would think that meant something that they could deal with. But we're organized with about 65 to 125 people all around the world we work with, and so we're really a coordinating entity. In many ways. So when people find that we're sponsoring research, and they often think, you know, we're funding it, what we really do is we coordinate research that people are already beginning to undertake. And the consequence of that research is that we then set about distributing it to other people, and at least the results of it. So we focus on two broad areas. One is natural medicine through what we have called the Center for Traditional Medicine, which was actually incorporated into the center about, 10 years ago now. And the other area is Fourth World Geopolitics, or Fourth World Studies. And we call it Fourth World because that's an area of identity that is shared between Indigenous peoples all around the world. They're not first world states, and they're not second world states, nor are they third world countries. They're fourth world peoples, and that means that they're actually a part of the 7,000 or so Indigenous nations in the world that happen to be surrounded by or underneath existing states. So we do fourth world studies, philosophy, history, economics, social research, and then traditional medicine.
How did a small town boy end up studying, you know, these very deep geopolitical questions?
People kept asking questions. I kept trying to answer them.
Yeah, and you got more questions, didn't you?
Yeah, a lot more questions.
Funny how that works. I imagine that the internet has been quite a boon to your work.
Oh, it's it's a funny thing. When we first started, all of our communications were by people running by using the postal service and or telex. And when we would try to communicate with people around the world, we would expect communication exchanges to take anywhere from a month to a year. And so it wasn't instantaneous by any means. It sounds like it was really ancient. It was only 25 years ago that we were practicing things that way. But one of our people, we started playing around with computers in the middle 1980s to basically catalog the material that we've been putting together. And we've been scanning or actually typing a lot of the stuff into word processors and making text files. And the upshot of that was that we developed a fairly considerable library, actually, of materials. And we put them on what was then called a bulletin board. People could call and download these things on their 300 baud modems. Well, we had text files, and so, of course, that would allow them to go pretty fast. But by 1992, a fellow who was working on this project came in to me, and he said, listen, we could put this bulletin board on a thing called the World Wide Web. And I said, it's for the world? Yeah. It's wide? Yeah. It's a web? Let's do it, I said. I have no idea what that means, but let's get going with it. So in 1992, we went on the World Wide Web. And we've had what's now called the George Manuel Library, which is a part of the international internet system of libraries, since about 1993.
We just aired an interview with a man who co-wrote a book entitled Strangely Like War, The Global Assault on Forests. And the premise is that the way we treat forests healthcare and the natural world in general is very much like war. How does that war continue? I mean, assuming you agree with this premise, and I believe you do, how does that war continue against the surviving indigenous cultures of the world? I mean, the Indian War, certainly in the Northwest, ended, middle 1800s, something by about 1880, the majority of the real wars, the shooting wars, were over. But the war doesn't end when the shooting stops.
Well, I think, we hear an awful lot about the word war these days, and actually, frankly, I think it's a little overused. What we're really talking about is people doing violence to the natural world and to other people. They make, and interestingly enough, in that structure of what I just said, I sounded like, and in fact did, separate people from the natural world. I said the natural world and people. That's the mistake we make. We continue to think of human beings as something apart from nature.
But indigenous people never did that.
Well, indigenous peoples don't do that, and there's a good reason for that. And that is, they live in an environment where culture is present. Culture is a sort of dynamic and evolving relationship between people and the land and the cosmos. That's the simplest and most direct way of describing culture, and virtually all human beings have had connection to a culture in one form or another. But the problem is that some people who say we're not indigenous, as opposed to those who say they are indigenous, say, well, what's the difference? And the difference is this. Indigenous peoples know their culture, and non-indigenous peoples have forgot. The consequence of having forgot one's culture is that it's easy to do violence on other things, thinking there are no consequences. When you recognize and comprehend your own culture, violence has consequences, and they are immediate and they're present.
Well, that's heavy. We're talking with Rudy Reeser. Dr. Rudy Reeser is the co-founder and the chair of the Center for World Indigenous Studies. I'm Paul Nelson. Well, let's talk about that. We have governmental culture, if you will, that seems to believe that violence is the immediate answer. They say that violence is a last resort, but $401 billion spent on defense, and I use that term loosely, that dwarfs the defense budgets of basically the rest of the world. So what have they lost that makes them think that violence is a solution?
Well, I suppose it's less really what they've lost than, as I suggested earlier, than what human beings have forgot. And that is that all things ultimately are connected in one form or another, whether we like it or not. All human beings are, all birds, all trees, all rocks. And they're all a part of a living universe that we're a part of. Now, that all sounds very heavy and philosophical, but the fact is, when you decide that you're separate and apart from all of that, when you're separate and distinct from all of that, as people who are, frankly, forgetting their relationship to the world, everything ends up being an enemy, and it's a threat. And your biggest purpose in life, then, is to defend against your own fears. The creation of something like the city and the state, for example, are both responses to fear. They're really they're contrary to the kinds of things that human beings actually had been practicing for a very long time. So what is it that creates this fear? Well, it's the unknown. And the response to all of that is to build up an overwhelming capacity to defeat what you fear. And that's, of course, what's going on heavily now in the United States. The United States is overcome by fear. And its tendency, therefore, is to create the defenses against the things it doesn't understand.
Yeah. Culture shaping illness. So yeah. this whole, and I'm reminded of the difference between FDR and President Bush. The only fear we have is fear itself, whereas Bush and the whole, Homeland Security and the color alerts and all this, they seem to be perpetuating fear. So that tremendous difference in that.
Yeah, that's an unfortunate thing.